This is Kirk Benwood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Everyone loves a Halloween story, and our volunteers have got a few to tell you. So, welcome to the TRRS Midnight Macabre. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Listen to TRRS for announcements about program times, or check our website at www.triangleReadingService.org to review our complete schedule, or call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. That number again is 919-832-5138. So who's with me tonight?
Hi, I'm Jim Cronin.
Hi, I'm Gina Benoy.
Hi, Karen Rains.
Lindsay Moore here.
Fred Corlett here.
I'm Jeff Nugent.
And Jim's going to kick us off with The Bloody Knife,
a Nova Scotia ghost story from the Mi'kmaq tribe, retold by S.E. Schlosser. Many and many a year ago, two Mi'kmaq warriors from rival villages got into a terrible argument. Harsh words were exchanged and then knives were pulled. The warriors battled back and forth on the banks of a small creek. They fought with ferocity of grizzlies, tearing at each other with their knives, ripping at each other's clothes and hair. Suddenly, one of the warriors slipped on the muddy bank and fell into the waters of the creek. His bloody knife slipped from his hand and sank down and down to the bottom, landing upon a rock just beyond his reach. The warrior strained his pain-racked body towards the knife as his blood filled the waters of the creek, but it was just beyond his fingertips. He thrashed and clawed towards the knife, desperate to reach it before his rival could kill him, but no matter how he stretched, it always slipped out of reach. On the bank above, the victorious Mi'kmaq warrior saw his rival sink into the blood-stained waters and lay still, the knife just a hair-breadth beyond his fingertips. He did not rise again. The fallen man's people found him a few hours later and tenderly rescued his body from the rippling waters of the creek. But when they tried to retrieve his bloody knife from the rock beneath him, it always slipped away beyond their reach, though the creek was not deep. Many and many a year has passed since that bloody day by the creek, and still the blood-stained knife lies beneath the rippling waters of the creek. Whenever anyone tries to reach it, the knife slips out of reach. It is like trying to touch something on the bottom of the sea, although the creek itself is not very deep. Even the rushing waters of the spring season do not move the mysterious knife or wash away the blood staining its blade. For this reason, the creek is called Woken, meaning knife by the Mi'kmaq people, and the white men call it Bloody Creek.
Ghost Ship of Captain Sandoval, a New Jersey ghost story retold by S.E. Schlosser. When Captain Dan Sandoval voyaged from Spain to the New World in search of treasure, he found gold in abundance. But among his crew there were many sailors who did not wish to share the newfound wealth with the monarchs of Spain. On their journey up the Atlantic coast, the sailors mutinied and imprisoned their captain, tying him to the main mast and refusing to give him food or drink. Day after day, the captain lay exposed to the hot sun of summer, his body drying up as the treacherous sailors worked around him. Finally, his pride broken, Don Sandoval begged, "Water, please. Give me just one sip of water." The mutineers found this amusing and started carrying water up to the main mast and holding it just out of reach of their former captain. In the terrible heat of a dry summer, the captain did not survive long without water. A few days after the mutiny, the captain succumbed to the heat and thirst. The new captain, a greedy Spaniard with no compassion in his soul, left Don Sandoval tied to the mast, his body withering away, while the ship turned pirate and plundered its way up the coast. But Providence was watching the ruthless men, and a terrible storm arose and drove the ship deep into the Atlantic, where it sank with all hands, the body of Don Sandoval still tied to the broken mast. Shortly after the death of the mutineers turned pirate, an eerie ghost ship began appearing along the coast, usually in the calm just before a storm. It had the appearance of a Spanish treasure ship, but its mast was broken, its sails torn, and the corpse of a noble-looking Spaniard was tied to the mast. The ship was crewed by skeletons in ragged clothing. As it passed other ships or houses near the shore, the skeletons would stretch out bony hands and cry,
"Water, please, give us just one sip of water."
But none can help them, for they are eternally doomed to roam the Atlantic, suffering from the thirst in payment for their terrible deeds against their captain and the good people living along the Atlantic coast.
The Black Cat's Message, a Texas Halloween story, retold by S. E. Schlosser. I came home late one night after work and found my wife Ethel puttering about the kitchen with a big yellow cat at her heels. "And who is this?" I asked jovially. "This is our new cat," said Ethel, giving me a hug and a kiss to welcome me home. "She just appeared at the kitchen door and wanted to come in. None of the neighbors know where she came from, so I guess she's ours. It will be nice to have some company around the house." I bent down and scratched the yellow cat under the chin. She purred and stretched. "Well, I think our income can stretch far enough to feed three," I said. My son had taken over my job at the mercantile, and my wife and I were enjoying leisurely old age. I liked to keep busy, though, so I spent a few hours every day cutting and hauling wood to be used at the mill. I went out to milk the cow, and when I came back in, Ethel gave the cat some cream in a saucer. We sat on the porch after dinner, and the cat sat with us. "You are a very nice kitty," I said to her. She purred loudly. "Donald," Ethel said. She sounded worried. I turned to look at her. "The neighbors acted rather oddly when I told them about the cat. They seemed to think that she was a ghost or a witch of some sort, transformed into a cat. They told me to get rid of her." "A witch?" I asked, and laughed heartily. "Are you a witch, little cat?" The cat yawned and stretched. Reluctantly, Ethel started to laugh with me. It seemed such a ludicrous notion. We sat watching the beautiful sunset, and then took ourselves to bed. The cat quickly became an essential part of our household. She would purr us awake each morning and would beg for cream when I brought in the morning's milking. She followed Ethel around, supervising her work during the day, and would sit by the fire at night while we read aloud. The days became shorter as autumn approached, and often I would work until nearly sunset, cutting and hauling wood. One night in October, I didn't finish hauling my last load until dusk. As soon as I had piled the last log on, I started down the road, hoping to get home before dark, since I had not brought a lantern with me. I rounded the corner and saw a group of black cats standing in the middle of the road. They were nearly invisible in the growing dark. As I drew nearer, I saw they were carrying a stretcher between them. I stopped and rubbed my eyes. That was impossible. Then I looked again. The stretcher was still there, and there was a little dead cat lying on it. I was astonished. "It must be a trick of the light," I thought. Then one of the cats called out, "Sir, please tell Aunt Can that Polly Grundy is dead." My mouth dropped open in shock. I shook my head hard, not believing my ears. How ridiculous, I thought. Cats don't talk. I hurried past the little group, carefully looking the other way. I must be working too hard, I thought, but I couldn't help wondering who Aunt Can might be. And why did the cat want me to tell her Polly Grundy was dead? Was Polly Grundy the cat on the stretcher? Suddenly I was confronted by a small black cat. It was standing directly in front of me. I stopped and looked down at it. It looked back at me with large green eyes that seemed to glow in the fading light.
"I have a message for Aunt Can," the cat said. "Tell her that Polly Grundy is dead."
The cat stalked past me and went to join the other cats grouped around the stretcher. I was completely nonplussed. This was getting very spooky. Talking cats.
and a dead Polly Grundy. And who was Aunt Can? I hurried away as fast as I could walk. Around me the woods were getting darker and darker. I did not want to stay in that wood with a group of talking cats. Not that I really believed the cats had spoken. It was all a strange waking dream brought on by too much work. Behind me the cats gave a strange shriek and called out together, "Old man, tell Aunt Can that Polly Grundy is dead!" I'd had enough. I sprinted for home as fast as I could and didn't stop until I had reached the safety of my porch. I paused to catch my breath. I did not want to explain to Ethel that I was seeing and hearing impossible things. She would dose me with castor oil and call the doctor. When I was sufficiently composed, I went into the house and tried to act normally. I should have known it wouldn't work. Ethel and I had been married for 30 years, and she knew me inside and out. She didn't say anything until after I'd finished the chores. Then she sat me down in front of the fire and brought me my supper. After I'd taken a few bites and started to relax, she said, "Tell me all about it, Donald." "I don't want to worry you," I said, reluctant to talk about what I had seen and heard on the way home. The yellow cat was lying by the fire. She looked up when she heard my voice and came to sit by my chair. I offered her a morsel of food, which she accepted daintily. "I'll worry more if you don't tell me," said Ethel. "I think maybe something is wrong with my brain," I said slowly. While I was walking home, I thought I saw a group of black cats carrying a stretcher with a dead cat on it. Then I thought I heard the cats talking to me. They asked me to tell Aunt Can that Polly Grundy was dead. The yellow cat leapt onto the windowsill. "Polly Grundy is dead," she cried. "Then I am the Queen of Witches." She switched her tail and the window flew open with a bang. The yellow cat leapt through it and disappeared into the night, never to return. Ethel had to dump an entire bucket of water over my head to revive me from my faint. "The good news," she told me when I sat up, dripping and swearing because the water was ice cold, "is that you have nothing wrong with your brain. The bad news is that our cat has just left to become the Queen of the Witches. We'll have to get another cat." "Oh, no," I said immediately. "I've had enough of cats. We got a dog."
That Pesky Fellow, a Newfoundland folktale, retold by S.E. Schlosser. A fisherman from Newfoundland was having difficulty finding someone to assist him. Help was scarce, and he couldn't find a soul to hire. Then one day, he saw a handsome fellow in fancy city clothes walking along the docks. This was obviously not a man looking for work, but the fisherman still called out, half in jest, "Are ye looking for some work?" To his surprise, the city man nodded and jumped into the boat. They agreed to split the catch into three parts, one for the city man, one for expenses, and one for the fisherman. Then they set out in the boat. At first, the skipper caught 3 fish to every fish caught by the city man. He was quite disgusted by this performance. At this rate, he would have done better fishing alone. So he said, "Am I supposed to catch all the fish for you? Why don't you catch some?" "Well then, if it's fish you're looking for," said the pesky stranger, "how about these?" He grabbed the fish gaff and smacked the port side of the vessel 3 times. "Come aboard, fish," he shouted. Immediately, fish of every shape and size came leaping out of the water onto the port side and flopped into the bottom of the boat. The stranger then hit the starboard side of the boat 3 times, and fish came hopping and flopping in from that direction until the boat was so full the skipper could barely see the stranger over the mound of fish. "Stop or you'll drown us both!" he shouted to the city man. Well, that pesky city fellow held up the fish gaff, and immediately the fish stopped jumping into the boat. The skipper eyed the catch, and then grinned in delight at the city man. "I wish I'd brought us a spot of rum," he cried enthusiastically. "We should celebrate this fine catch." "A spot of rum coming up," said that pesky fellow. He bore a hole into the mast with a little gimlet he took from his pocket and outpoured enough rum to fill a mug. Then he bore a second hole into the mast and poured himself some whiskey. By this time, the skipper was marveling at the magic produced by the pesky city fellow, but he wasn't about to ask how he'd pulled off such stupendous tricks. He was just grateful to benefit from them. He topped off his rum from the hole in the mast and then turned the boat towards the shore. The stranger wanted to steer, but the skipper wasn't sure where that pesky fellow would take the boat, so he politely declined the offer, and the man grinned knowingly and poured himself some more whiskey. When they reached the docks, the two men sat down and started dividing the catch between them. "Lay one out for you, one for expenses, and one for the devil," the pesky city fellow said with a lazy grin. So that was what the skipper did. He made three piles, and they kept throwing the one fish at a time into the pile, chanting, "One for me, one for expenses, one for the devil," until the entire catch was divided. The skipper put the devil's portion on a wooden rack, called a stage, that was used for drying fish. "Much obliged," said the pesky fellow with a happy grin. He kicked over the stage, leapt into the sea with his portion of the catch, and the whole kit and caboodle disappeared in a puff of smoke. The skipper shook his head a few times. Then he went back to the mast to pour himself some more rum. But both of the boreholes had disappeared, along with that pesky fellow.
Don't Turn on the Light, retold by S.E. Schlosser. She commandeered the room in the basement of her dorm as soon as she realized she would have to pull an all-nighter in order to prepare for tomorrow's final exam. Her roommate, Jenna, liked to go to bed early, so she packed up everything she thought she would need and went downstairs to study, and study, and study some more. It was 2 o'clock when she realized that she'd left one of the textbooks upstairs on her bed. With a dramatic sigh, she rose and climbed the stairs slowly to her third-floor dorm room. The lights were dim in the long hallway, and the old boards creaked under her weary tread. She reached her room and turned the handle as softly as she could, pushing the door open just enough to slip inside so that the hall lights wouldn't wake her roommate. The room was filled with a strange metallic smell. She frowned a bit, her arms breaking out into chills. There was a strange feeling of malice in the room, as if a malevolent gaze were fixed upon her. It was a mind trick. The all-nighter was catching up with her. She could hear Jenna breathing on the far side of the room, a heavy sound, almost as if she had been running. Jenna must have picked up a cold during the last tense week before finals. She crept along the wall until she reached her bed, groping among the covers for the stray history textbook. In the silence, she could hear a steady drip, drip, drip sound. She sighed silently. Facilities would have to come fix the sink in the bathroom. Again. Her fingers closed on the textbook. She picked it up softly and withdrew from the room as silently as she could. Relieved to be out of the room, she hurried back downstairs, collapsed into an overstuffed chair, and studied until 6 a.m. She finally decided that enough was enough. She slipped upstairs now. She could get a couple of hours' sleep before her 9 o'clock exam. The first of the sun's rays were beaming through the windows as she slowly slid the door open, hoping not to awaken Jenna. Her nose was met by an earthy, metallic smell a second before her eyes registered the scene in the dorm room. Jenna was spread-eagled on top of her bed against the far wall, her throat cut from ear to ear and her nightdress stained with blood. 2 drops of blood fell from the saturated blanket with a drip, drip noise that sounded like a leaky faucet. Scream after scream poured from her mouth, but she couldn't stop herself any more than she could cease wringing her hands. All along the hallway, doors slammed and footsteps came running down the passage. Within moments, other students had gathered in her doorway, and one of her friends gripped her arm with a shaking hand and pointed a trembling finger toward the wall. Her eyes widened in shock at what she saw. Then she fainted into her friend's arms. On the wall above her bed, written in her roommate's blood, were the words, "Aren't you glad you didn't turn on the light?"
Golden Hand, from Spooky Oregon, retold by S.E. Schlosser. He never paid much attention to the neighbors living on his city block until the day the pretty middle-aged widow moved in two doors down from him. She was plump and dark with sparkling eyes, and she always wore dark gloves on her hands, even indoors. He went out of his way to meet her, and they often bumped into each other in the street and stood talking. One day, as she brushed the hair back from her forehead, he caught a glimpse of gold under the glove on her right arm. When he asked her about it, she grinned coquettishly and told him that she had lost one hand a few years back and now wore a golden hand in its place. In that moment, a terrible lust woke in his heart, not to possess the lady herself, but to possess the solid gold hand that she wore under her long black gloves. He courted the widow with every stratagem known to him, flowers, trips to the theater, gifts, compliments, and he won her heart. Within a month, they were standing in front of a minister, promising to love one another until death parted them. Within another month, he was a widower and had buried his ailing wife in the local cemetery without her golden hand. It had been so easy. A slow poison, administered daily to resemble a wasting disease. No one, not his wife, not the family doctor, not their neighbors, suspected murder. And the night after the funeral, he slept with the golden hand under his pillow. It was a dark night. Clouds covered the moon, and the wind was whistling down the chimney and rattling the shutters of the townhouse. He was deeply asleep when the door to his room slammed open with a loud bang, and a wild wind whipped around the room, scattering papers and books and clothing and table coverings every which way. He sat up, startled by the sudden noise, and his pulse began to pound when he saw a greenish-white light bobbing slowly into the room. Before his eyes, the light slowly grew larger, taking on the shape of his dead wife. She was missing one arm. "Where is my golden hand?" she moaned, her dark eyes blazing with red fire. "Give me my golden hand!" He tried to speak, but his mouth was so dry with fear that he could only make soft gasping noises. The glowing phantom moved closer to him, her once lovely face twisted into a hideous green mask. "You stole my life and you stole my hand. Give me back my golden hand," the dead wife howled. The noise rose higher and higher, and the phantom pulsed with a strident green light that smote his eyes, making them water. He cowered back against his pillows, and the hard shape of the golden hand pressed against his back. And then he felt the golden hand twitch underneath him, as a mangled green phantom that had been his wife swooped down upon him, pressing his face against the pillow in a suffocating green cloud. He tried to scream, but it was cut off suddenly by a terrible pressure against his throat, cutting off his breath. The world went black. The next morning, when the housemaid came into the room with her master's morning cup of tea, she found him lying dead on the floor, with the golden hand clutched around his throat.
The Flying Canoe, a French-Canadian folktale, retold by S.E. Schlosser. Long ago, there were a number of lonely lumberjacks working in the center of a very large forest. They cut down mammoth trees and watched them crash into the thick snow in exactly the place where they said the trees would land. They would cut up the trees and haul them hither and thither. They worked hard, mon Dieu, very hard indeed. But they were lonely for the women they had left behind. On New Year's Day, it snowed so hard no work could be done. The men huddled in their camp and spoke longingly of their home. They passed around the rum and drank toast to the new year. But finally, Baptiste said what they were all thinking. I wish to go home today and see my girl. There were murmurs of agreement, but Jean replied, How can we go home today? There is more than 2 meters of snow on the road, and more snow is falling. Who said we were walking out of here? Asked Baptiste. I am going to paddle out in my canoe. Now the men all knew that Baptiste had a canoe with paddles out back of the camp. Baptiste had made a pact with the devil. If the devil would make the canoe fly wherever Baptiste wished, the lumberjack would not say mass for an entire year. However, if Baptiste did not return the canoe before dawn of the day after he used it, the devil could keep his soul. While Baptiste and his companions were in La Chasse Galerie, they could not say the names of God or fly over a church or touch any crosses, or the canoe would crash. Many of the men refused to participate in Baptiste's New Year's scheme, but he managed to find 7 companions to fly with him in the canoe back to their hometown to visit their women. Baptiste and his friends got into the canoe, and Baptiste said the magic words, Acabris, Acabris, Acabrum. When Baptiste was done binding himself to the devil, the canoe rose into the air, and the men began to paddle their way through the sky to their home. Their womenfolk were so glad to see them. They celebrated long into the night, drinking and dancing. It was close to dawn when the men realized they had to return the canoe to the lumber camp by dawn or forfeit their souls. They searched for Baptiste and found him as drunk as a lord, lying under a table at the inn. They bundled him into the canoe, spoke the magic words, and paddled away. Knowing that Baptiste would start swearing if they woke him, one of the men tied him up and gagged him so he would not speak the name of God at an inopportune moment and crash the canoe. When Baptiste awoke, he sat up, struggling with the ropes that bound him. He managed to loosen the gag and shouted, Mon Dieu, why have you tied me up? At the name of God, the canoe took a nosedive, plunging towards the ground. It hit the top of a large pine tree, and all the men tumbled out and fell down, down into the darkness just before dawn. They were never seen again.
You've been listening to a session of Midnight Macabre on Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. If you want to check out our program guide, please visit our website at www.triangleReadingService.org. While you're there, you might notice we have several programs on podcast. Meanwhile, this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Kurt Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. From me and from my fellow readers, good night.